Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. It's me, Chris Denson, your gracious host, Densonology on all the socials or at Innovation Crush on the other socials. If you guys are tuning in for the first time, this show covers all things innovation, ideas, creativity, smart people doing smart things, and we almost are wearing matching shirts, but not really. Eric Olson, say hello.
Hi. Great to be here, Chris.
It is great to have you here. It's even more important. I'm always here, so that's one key differentiator. I guess for those who may not know you or your work, I would love if you could kind of give an abbreviated overview.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The four-floor elevator pitch.
There you go.
I'm the design director at Carton Design. We're an innovation consultancy not too far away from the studio here in Los Angeles. Got about a 30-year history. And over that time of developing products and services for lots of big companies across the globe, we've really developed an expertise and have dedicated ourselves to doing medical devices. So really are now applying all the great experience that we've had and expertise in doing innovation, developing new products and services, and applying that to healthcare, which is exciting and challenging
and you're not a doctor.
Those good things. Nope.
Which makes it even harder, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things that struck me just first and foremost was, I mean, you've been part of this company since 96.
Yeah. 98? Yeah.
Which is something you just never hear anymore. Like, nobody's at a company. You know, there was a guy we spoke with earlier who is like 1 to 3 years, 2.5 years there. Amassed all this amazing experience.
Yeah, like the shortest resume ever.
Right. And I was just curious as to, like, you know, what's the advantage of staying at a company for the amount of time that you have? And what are some disadvantages? Because I think, you know, you take that 3 to 5 year average time at a company, like, there are some advantages in, like, you're always bringing fresh eyes, you developed a different kind of Rolodex, but then you don't get to see a longer term thing, you know, through.
Right. But yeah. So obvious disadvantages. I was joking, only half kidding about having the shortest resume ever. Right. You don't get to click off, you know, 5 companies that you worked at and hope that maybe 2 or 3 of those really resonate with whomever you're talking to when you go to get a job. The obvious advantage is I'm not going out and looking for a job all the time. So it's sort of irrelevant. But, you know, working for a design firm, Carton Design is a consultancy, and we're always working on 6 or 8 projects at a time. So imagine multiply that over the course of a year and then multiply that by 20 something years. I'm going to start counting by fives now pretty soon. it really gives, and I'm not the longest tenured employee there.
Wow.
So there have been some people there longer than I have. And what that really lets you see is just such a wide group of challenges and companies, and as you can imagine, you start seeing similarities and differences. And, you know, I'm sure at some point we'll talk more about this, but I really believe that one of the great parts of innovation is being able to mash up and pull things together from maybe not so obvious references. And
we won't talk about that at all.
I know you don't care about that. Not a subject we'll really care about
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's
the biggest advantage. Just a huge pool of different crazy things to pull from.
I was going
to
say, I think sometimes the misperception, you know, with an organization like yours is that you only do one thing, right? You've been doing the same thing for.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, ask any person who's been at an agency for a long, like the number of clients and the types of things you get to work on. And especially if you're inventing and mashing things.
Right.
So I guess, you know, where do you guys start, right? Because when you think about medical technology, I guess, or medical innovation or device innovation, part of a journey of being there that long is sometimes just things like federal regulations or the processes that you need to go through in order to make something happen. I guess walk us through a little bit of the, you know, from the ideation to fruition, you know, what that journey is like, and maybe cite an example of a product in it.
Yeah, sure. So we really pride ourselves on being a user-centric organization, really taking to heart, you know, what has now become best practices in design and development, which is to really listen to the people who are going to be using your product or your service when you're all done. So what that really looks like, regardless of how difficult or how complicated the device is or how long the process is going to take. And in med device, it can take years. Is really making sure that the foundation is solid and we really understand what the stakeholders' needs are. And I say stakeholders because, unlike a pair of headphones in med device, the user could be a doctor, maybe another doctor, a nurse, you know, a med tech. There's a rep involved. Typically, there's a patient. There's a patient's caregivers, plural, or their family. You know, all those people have a stake in the success or failure of a device. And by success or failure, I mean, can it be used? And is it something that, you know, really has a great effect? And also, you know, does that company, you know, the company that we work for needs to have financial gain at the end? You know, this is a for-profit enterprise that we're doing, and in addition to an altruistic one as well. So I'd say that is the biggest and most important start that we really believe in, is understanding and going out and doing the face-to-face research with as many people as we can possibly get connected with. Doesn't necessarily mean there's 100 doctors that you talk to. It could only be two or three, but to be able to talk to each of those people, bring out our clients so they can hear firsthand. This is the foundation that really sets the goals for device development, and make sure that you stay really true to what the focus is throughout it, because there's going to be challenges along the way, being dragged left to right by things. So that's probably the most important part.
Well, with all those stakeholders you mentioned, you know, where's the starting point from, you know, you get that phone call and you're like, all right, we need to go talk to some doctors, some patients, some technologists, like or do you go, all right, here's five ideas we think might work, and then we'll go socialize those. What's the starting point with a lot of these?
The starting point we typically believe in is to ask first before we tell. But a lot of times, as you know, we're working for companies that are filled with a lot of very smart, very hardworking people, and they have been in spaces longer than we have. So in the case of a device company, they may be on Gen 5 of something. There may be people in the company who have PhDs in this subject and have been working in this area for 5, 10, 20 years. So we don't believe, are sort of ego-free as we go in, and so we don't believe that we have answers that they don't have. So the first steps, actually, before we actually get out into the field, are typically to talk to those internal teams first and learn as much as quickly as we can. You know, have to become sort of armchair quarterbacks as quickly as we can, just so we can even keep up with the really smart people that understand the complexities of these. So
I'm gonna try to do some science words.
Yeah. Okay.
Neuromodulation. Renal denervation.
Did I pronounce that word? Yeah, two for two.
Orthopedic diagnostics. Dental operatory.
Yeah.
I have no idea what any of these things mean. What I like about you is that you probably don't either. At least when you walk into a room, right?
Yeah.
And I guess tell me a little bit about that fresh eyes perspective, and like being so naive to, an industry or a problem, or, you know, especially when it comes to the human, like how we better medical care. Like, it's one of the most important innovation verticals that I can think of. You know, it's not like it's a social media app.
Right.
But that idea of learning and adopting and then applying and also developing trust with whomever you're working with. They're using words that I can barely pronounce.
Yeah, one of the great things about bringing our clients out into the actual environment of use and talking to the users of products is, many times a lot of these amazing engineers haven't had the opportunity to go out and spend a lot of time with the end user. So together, what you hear and the feedback that you get from ideas and the challenges you hear becomes super powerful for everybody. So at least there's a level playing field, and everybody in some cases is hearing some of these comments and some of these challenges that doctors and patients are facing implementing a new technology or next gen for the same time. So that's pretty nice that's like, it's sort of a fair playing field in that respect.
Right.
Because the actual technical application is totally unfair. We will never come up to a full understanding, really, of exactly the mechanism of action of some of these things. You know, neuromodulation is pretty complicated, technology, and it's not something that we get so under the hood with that we understand it in a deep way. But what we can bring is the experience that's twofold to this that maybe even the most amazing engineer doesn't have the expertise in. And that is, to some degree, bringing that experience of attraction and that emotional connection, which mm-hmm. we really think has been lacking in med device for a long time.
Explain the attraction part.
Yeah. So in the past, you know, in consumer products, you can imagine you design for something that's going to be sold on the shelf at from Procter & Gamble, or a set of headphones that's going to be in Best Buy or something right. like that. There's an expectation that those things have an emotional attraction to them. When you see that on the shelf, you want consumers to say, whoa, that is me.
That's cool.
I want that. That's cool. You know, that's really going to speak to me. And then there's a functional aspect, obviously. It's got to sound good or perform well. In the past, for medical devices, it was okay just to have efficacy. As long as this thing saves lives and gets, and provides improvements to patient health.
Yeah.
What it looks like and whether they are scared off by this is really, really immaterial. But as anyone who's watching the healthcare space knows and is starting to read about, there's increasing choice from patients. Patients are aware of treatments. They're doing their own research. They're going on Google. They're seeing ads for pharmaceuticals. You know, they're coming
Which
into
can be a good and a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But regardless of whether it's good or bad, the expectations are set, and patients and doctors and all these everybody who's involved in this really have the expectation now that medical devices are just as cool, work just as well, you know, can be used just as simply as consumer electronics or anything else.
Right? Yeah. Well, one of my favorite examples from your portfolio of projects, and especially like it being rooted in some interesting data points, right? Which is hearing loss in this example. There are 48 million people who suffer from hearing loss. And the other statistic you had on your website was that it's almost 7 years from the time that they know that they actually go and do something about it or purchase a device.
Yep.
And so the Starkey, I want to say what, speaking of design and looking cool from both a visual standpoint and a functional standpoint, I think is a great example of what you just
mentioned. It has to do both, right?
Yeah.
For years, hearing aids really are little supercomputers. They're really amazing pieces of hardware. But the fact that they kind of look like beige shrimp behind your ear for years and years and years has had a whole generation of people that are like, whoa, not me. That is stigmatizing. That is code for I'm old, you know, and I'm infirm. One of our biggest challenges is to, hey, if we can't get somebody to want a hearing aid, we should at least make that thing look like it's worth the $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 that it could make to be. You know, when you're holding it in your hand, it's got to look like it's got some value to it. And then when you put it on your ear, if we can make that thing disappear and try to alleviate some of that stigma, those are emotional conversations, right? We're not affecting the performance. I mean, we can help in some areas, but if there's ways that we can make this disappear and let people, they just want to get on with their lives.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want technology to get in the way or to have it be flashy. They want it to take a back seat so they can get on with what they want to do, which is playing golf, you know, talking to the grandkids, whatever the case may be. So
no, that's an amazing example. And also I think the reason I like that example as well, because it was also iPhone compatible.
Yep.
So being like, it adds another level of convenience. Like, how much of that type of multifunctionality are you thinking about when you go into the design process? Or, you know, are you going like, it needs to look cool, we need to decrease that 7-year gap of purchase? Or is it like, okay, phones are basically lifeblood of most of us today. So like, where's the design thinking come into?
Yeah, that's a good example. It's why we built a UX UI practice, because that's a blurry line these days between a device and software. You know, even the most dedicated medical device is probably throwing off data to some clinician portal somewhere else, or maybe connecting to a smartphone. And this is just the way of the world. So for sure, from a holistic perspective, it's looking at the whole experience. Consumers and users and doctors and patients, they don't think about the iPhone or the, you know, their Samsung phone as a device. They think about it as a device with a service, with apps. You know, it's all one thing in their mind. So you have to look at it together completely and keep focused on, again, what is the end result? If the end result is to get this product or this service or this device to work seamlessly with someone's lifestyle, then you should be thinking about their golf game, not so much about, you know, about the device.
Having a conversation in the living room.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, I think that's even just in the sake of the hearing aid example, that immediately where I go to is like, I don't want to talk to my grandmother like this.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
But let alone the phone calls or the round of golf or being able to go swimming.
Right? Yeah, like, yeah.
So that's the
sort of real end result that we're
which I swim with my phone all the time.
Your example is a good one though, in terms of like, how can something find its way into the background? So hearing aids that are enabled to connect with smartphones means, for example, that you could geotag your coffee shop. And when your phone knows that you just walked into that coffee shop, it automatically flips your hearing aid into a mode that has already been preset for that exact coffee shop
that cuts
out the background noise. So, you know, so that chatter in the background drops out and you can actually have a conversation with someone. So that's who cares about the technology?
Yeah.
Once that's developed, that should really sort of disappear and fade into the background, you know?
You have one of those jobs where people are like, that sounds fun. Like, it, you know, because to be able to think freely about all these things. Tell me about the hurdles. Because I'm sure for like every example we can talk about, there's probably like a dozen things on the cutting room floor for whatever reasons.
Yeah,
or, you know, regulatory startup that you were connected to didn't necessarily pan out. Like, walk us through some of the dark sides of of your magic.
Yeah, broadly speaking, I think anyone who's in daily product development will tell you that their ego drops away pretty quickly because you kill thousands of great. It seems like you kill thousands of great ideas every day. That's not really the case, but you just have to be able.
It feels like it.
Yeah, it does. Like, and if you get and you can't help but get emotionally involved in things, and then they could fall apart for any number of reasons. So that's just, I think that's just in general. And they kind of train you for that in design school by, you know, making you put your work up and then rip it down and come again tomorrow with more and, you know, more. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Just build up your emotional count. Yeah.
No, totally. It's funny. I mean, sorry, that's to cut you off. But like, you know, I'm speaking of boot. I did stand up for a while. You get a lot of those, right?
Yeah,
like, I think it builds up a weirder sense of resiliency.
Absolutely.
When somebody doesn't like my idea, I'm like, okay, well.
Yeah, right.
I really wanted to do it, but I guess it's not going to happen.
Yeah. It's a fallacy, really. I think that, you know, as you know, even stand up, you had a thousand bits, you know, and you put them together into maybe, you know, into a few minutes, right?
Yeah,
it's a
exactly.
fallacy to think that you just get up there and just like riff. It's practiced, and there's a, you know, you develop processes as kind of a defense mechanism. You're like, I don't know how this is going to go, but if I follow this process, I've done it 50 times before or 500 times before. I have, you know, I think I'll work through it and I'll get there. You know?
That's great. So, Mode mapping.
So that is a reaction. The story that we like to tell, it's a way to visualize information that we're getting from research. And really all it is a way of saying, oh, we're tracking the process of something maybe pretty complicated across a timeline and saying, okay, it starts with this and then this happens and then this happens and this happens. So imagine that on a visual grid from left to right. And then top to bottom on this same grid, this graph, if you will, is the emotional part of it, which is sort of new to any kind of informatics or anything. Usually most people just kind of capture what is. This happens and then this happens and then this happens. But what we layered onto the top of it was this understanding, so you could sort of see the line of someone's attention dropping way down and going way up. Imagine doing that. We did it when we first started for hearing aids. Imagine doing that for 20 different hearing aid users and then overlaying those graphics on top of each other and saying, whoa, everybody at this point, their emotional thing, mad are they about this? How upset? Not just like I'm annoyed, but like this sucks.
Furious.
Yeah. How many times is that dipping way down into this is not good for the brand, this is not good for anybody, right? In the hearing aid case, we overlaid those and it invariably led to a couple of different areas, one of which in particular was just loading batteries into hearing aids. So that gives you something where you're like, well, that is the first order of business. Let's spend as much time as we need to trying to make that experience better. Again, we may never get them to love hearing aids, but we could at least knock off the real brutal parts on there. So that's just a tool that we use.
And how did it come about? Like, you know, were you just like, we need something to do this? Or were you kind of like looking at those 20 different patients and then you made it into a system? Like, where did the...
Yeah, it came about from kind of the the part that we like to joke about is it came about from the aspect that designers aren't great with reading and digesting a lot of written material. Whether that means maybe it's our inability that led us into design, or
right.
I won't speak to that. But we recognize that there's lots and lots of research reports that end up in a binder in somebody's file cabinet somewhere. And being visual people, we wanted tools that we could look at on a wall together and go, ooh, look at that common, look at that common thing that we can see, because we're visual people. That's kind of where it started. It's actually, even though we built it selfishly, has become a great tool to communicate with internal teams with our clients too, because you've got stakeholders from marketing and engineering and business and management and, you know, all these different, and they need a common tool too. And a visual tool is, you know, can be sort of our math, that it's a universal way to look at something. And a lot of times it's qualitative information. It's not quant. You can't come up and say, 87% of people hate this. You're like, just look up here. You can just see for yourself, you know, this sucks. And you can tell it sucks across all these people that we put up on the wall. So let's go fix it.
That's great. I mean, because that's been an award-winning, you know, proprietary thing that you guys have done, as well as multiple awards for the products you've developed. Is there pressure to, you know, to sort of maintain a level of excellence, or is it kind of come naturally with the business that you're in? You know,
it's a side effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're great accolades, but you know, it's kind of like the Oscars. It's from juries of our peers. So it's good that, you know, it's nice to be recognized, but you know, there's no direct
one steak dinner will get you an award. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Right. There's no direct financial compensation. I think we're more excited to share business success or you know, success from an efficacy perspective. I get excited when our defibrillator client comes and says, oh, you know, you probably aren't tracking this like we are, but, you know, X thousands of people have lived because of this product. That's a number I can get behind. Or, you know, when a company that we work for, gets acquired, you know, and has an acquisition for $425 million. That's something we would say, okay, that's where pride comes more than like, oh, we got this like plaque, you know, from design.
Either way, like, it's excellence on both ends, right? I think it's great to, you know, because sometimes awards are empty just because it's like, okay.
Right.
But the fact that, you know, it's had real world results is awesome.
Yeah.
How much do you guys get to play? You know, it sounds like a lot of this is tied directly to an institution or a specific type of patient.
Yep.
But, you know, I know there's this bathroom of the future concept you've toyed around with. Yep. Like, where does like the white canvas come in versus the assigned, you know, work?
Oh, that's a good question. I had, you know, probably 10% of what we do or less.
Fair small.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Is that sort of, hey, let's just flex our muscles and flex our creativity. But we do dedicate time to
bathrooms.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. We dedicate a lot of time to the bathroom.
Yeah. You know, I mean, a lot of these things are just reactions to something that we're working on. And we just realize, wow, there's an opportunity here that doesn't really fit with any one particular client or brand. And maybe we're sort of obliged to promote this. Like this idea of bringing healthcare technology into the bathroom. That's not necessarily something that a sink manufacturer is going to take on. They're not tech people, and tech people aren't making plumbing, you know? So maybe it is a responsibility of a design firm to be a bit visionary and say, hey, if everybody worked together, you know, this could be an environment that could really be, you know, an area and a means of providing healthcare support and all, you know, has other benefits. So
you don't want to let things go down the drain.
Yeah, exactly.
It's terrible. I can do better. I promise. I would love if you don't mind, like with that example, just kind of walk us through some of the things that were envisioned in this bathroom, like the connected mirror to.
Yeah. Not to get too philosophical about it, but what you think is cool about the bathroom is that it is a common space that's used pretty much in privacy, unless you've got little kids or someone busting on you all the time, throughout your whole life across different life stages. Right. So even from infancy to teenage years, to, you know, single years, to maybe conception and starting a family, you get the idea.
Right.
It goes on and on. So that's pretty cool. And it already is sort of a place. The bathroom is a place already where you're doing some self-diagnosis, right? You know, yep. You're checking to see if that mole is growing or, you know, how things are doing. Again, it's in privacy, so that's a good area there. It's your pharmacy cabinet most of the time. It's a place where you're actually dealing with body fluids, which are, you know, fun. Of any other place. Yeah, that's always fun. But that's, you know, that's the best way to find out information about yourself.
Absolutely.
So it kind of has some inherent advantages there. And we thought it could be a cool place, again, to explore and bringing in healthcare technology in a seamless way. So that's well, like the important thing about it. It can't be a lab. You know?
Exactly. It does. The bathroom does. It's like your personal doctor's office.
Yeah.
Like in that instance, and especially I think at a time where more and more people are taking healthcare into their own hands in some way, whether it's, you know, exactly. The Oscars of the world or
yep.
The false promises of Theranos,
right?
You know, yeah, which was a great conceptually yep. Was like amazing, right? And yep. as we
and
all know,
still working on,
but solving it. Not just because of what it was, but because of the climate that we're in, yep. Right? And do you deal a lot with patient perception? Because I think there's this divide. I think just looking from the outside looking in between people who probably go to the doctor too much and people who are like, oh, that aches, I'm afraid to
find
out what it is.
Right.
Do you deal with that gap at all in some of the design or just as a, I don't know, like an, how do we close that gap a little bit more?
Yeah, we do. And I think what we try to keep in mind is there's a inherent paradox in healthcare right now, which is the people that really need to be, getting diagnoses and getting more feedback and watching and being proactive with are not the ones that are doing it. So they
right.
People joke about the worried well, right? That everybody who wants a CAT scan is probably not the people who should be getting a CAT scan. So I think where that goes back to is this idea of stigma and making things more fall back into the background and working with existing habits and ceremonies of people. So if we can make it, and there's exciting technologies out there that can help that, lots of great work being done in things like telemedicine. And that sounds like a fancy word, but what that really means in the real life is, you know, grandma who lives in the rural South somewhere mm-hmm. and has no means of even getting to the closest healthcare clinic, even if she had, you know, the impetus to, now via telemedicine could be someone who could be reached out to,
right.
and could reach back out to healthcare professionals without having to go through what could be a huge barrier, which is just getting to an appointment and getting back again.
There was, first of all, I had a fan moment recently. I mean, I'm having a fan moment now, but also, I was at a dinner and Louis Anderson was there.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm like a huge fan.
Yeah, right.
And, I grew up in Detroit and come to find out he's a spokesperson, and I forget the name of the organization in Detroit. And I guess Detroit has like the highest fetal death rate in the country.
Wow.
You just reminded me that I think that one of the top causes was transportation, being able to just wow. get to your appointments or your checkups. And so, I mean, I love that that's part of what you're thinking about because yes, there's grandma in, you know, in a rural part of Texas somewhere,
yeah, right.
but all, even in like bubbling metropolises,
yeah.
like there's still the same
difficult.
Sort of problem.
Yeah. And the clinic could be around the corner, but
yeah.
still there's just base barriers to that. So those are kind of the exciting things, like when very high tech solutions are being used to address things that for the patient are very, very simple,
yeah.
obvious.
Well,
things,
even like, I was going to ask you if you guys do any work globally, because that leads me to think about like in places like Japan where there's growing elderly populations.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons like personal home robots are becoming more and more of a thing because somebody's got to be able to go and check on grandma and like make sure the medicine was taken
right.
and or do some telepresence where it's like, hey, did you take your medicine? Like,
right.
In addition to just saying hello and, you know, being cordial. But,
right.
Does your work apply globally and what are some of the nuances that you look at if so?
Yeah, when given the opportunity, a lot of our clients and projects that we're working on are either already are or going to be released globally. And as you can imagine, there are amazing, crazy nuances in the healthcare system and even just cultural differences. And this could be even within countries, as you know, people in the US know how different it can be from coast to central areas. So yeah, that's a big part of understanding the nuances of that. A lot of it has to do with the healthcare providers, how much training they have, how much time they spend, and making sure that we work to make sure that services and devices work with whatever their workflow is.
Yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with cultural biases as well. A lot of times the barriers that might seem like technical barriers aren't technical barriers. They could be cultural barriers. That's just not a subject.
We don't talk about that.
Yeah, yet. Exactly. Yeah. We'd love to use the example. We were working on a research project for Kohler, a toilet project, and we were going in to find out about people's toileting behaviors. Not something that Kohler had really. You would expect a 100 and so something year old company who designed toilet would have done a lot of research in that regard, but they hadn't really gone through it. And we came to understand why that was so complicated. We were trying to recruit in multiple cities across the, just even within the US, and could not get recruits in Boston, Massachusetts. Huh. People in Boston were not interested in having us come in, and we weren't asking them to do anything per se in the bathroom, but couldn't do it. As opposed to that, or part of the recruiting, snapped up people in New York City, like, no problem at all. People are totally willing to address all of their...
The Great Boston Toilet Rebellion, as I like to refer to it as.
So, I mean, even within, even both on the East Coast, you can tell like how cultural barriers can be the difference between learning and not learning and designing intelligently for one group versus the other. So
that reminds me of, it was Fitbit. I think they just did the largest sleep study ever done in the history of the world because everyone, but they found all these like geographical nuances about like who sleeps more, men or women. Men in New York sleep, less time than men in Chicago, like different age groups, college campuses, et cetera, et cetera. But there's all usually in a practice like what you're doing, or even in that example, it's you find these undiscovered data points, which the toilet example is a great one. And so, again, just dealing with even more so than the functional design is like the cultural appetite.
Right.
Have you come across a scenario where a solution, the end user, this funny using toilet humor,
we had to have a pun jar, user. By the way, for that whole project.
Oh my gosh.
Like it was full of
terrible. There's, no, but do you find like the maybe it won't be adopted?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Unfortunately. Yeah. That happens. One example, we were really excited about this idea for hearing aids where we could use a capacitive switch. And for people not in the tech industry, that's, just like a touch switch. It might be on your microwave or something where you're just touching it would turn this on. So hearing aids have a little switch, a little rocker switch on the back that it lets people cycle through modes. Again, these are sort of becoming outdated on super high tech ones, but to be able to say, I'm driving the car is a different sound mode than maybe being listening to television or something like that. So fast forward to studying stigma and having people understand like, I don't want anyone to know I'm using a hearing aid. We thought it would be really cool if we use these capacitive touch switches on the back of hearing aids so that someone with just a gesture, almost like tucking their hair behind their ear, could be adjusting modes without fumbling with it and letting everybody know around the dinner table that, what are you doing behind your ear there?
Pull out a quarter.
Yeah. So we thought, well, what a great use of technology for, to reduce stigma and ease of use and all those great things. And it tested well and it got developed and the devices hit the market and it was just too complicated. We just really underestimated the cognitive and physical usability of this, considering a 70, 80 year old user.
Yeah.
It just didn't fly. And audiologists who were the ones prescribing and setting these things up just said, they just keep coming back. So many questions, so much burden for us to keep training this. So, it happens sometimes.
Yeah.
All the best of intentions. And even if you go through the rigor of testing, it's like, 87% of people, were successful. Sometimes it's just, you just either underestimate or overestimate something.
What I like about the company being around for this long is that you've seemingly stuck to your guns in terms of the medical application of your design thinking, as opposed to, because most companies want to diversify and diversify quickly. And now we're going to attack this vertical. Sure. And we're going to do stuff in automotive. Sure. And we're going to do stuff. Why stay narrow?
Well, we want to stay small. It lets us work in small teams. So we're, you know, and we want to make sure that we can focus and have the A team. There's no B team in our organization working on the most important projects. So that just limits, we have to be selective about the projects that we take to some degree. I think, not to be arrogant about it, but it's the big leagues. It's the most difficult, we believe, type of design to do. For a number of different reasons.
Sure.
You know, not only just the FDA part of it, but there's lots and lots of stakeholders. You're asking people to change. So from a human behavior thing, it's the most challenging. Yeah. It's expensive. It's complicated, all those things. So once we got some success doing that, it almost seemed like some of these other product categories were playing down a little bit. We still like the opportunity to take on other projects, but the ones that are outside healthcare right now that we would take on would be more something where we thought we could learn something about a technology that might eventually be applicable, or we might learn something about people that we didn't know. So I think that's it. Once we got the chops to be able to do that and got some experience doing it, it's also meaningful. You know, we have to recruit young designers and engineers and researchers and UX designers as much as anybody else does. And there's a whole generation of kids, call them kids because I'm old now, of students and grads and young people entering the workforce that really honestly care about what they're doing. They want to have meaning behind it. It's not okay to just churn out whatever.
Do you find that this happening more and more? I mean, there is some generational studying that's been done that suggests that, you know, millennials and Gen Z, you know, care more about doing good than previous generations. And have you seen it?
I've seen it. Cool. Yeah, I don't know what it is statistically, but yeah, we see it, and I don't know again whether
maybe in the space that you're in, it kind of comes with the territory, right?
Like, I think so, to some degree,
whoever's going to gravitate towards cares.
They find an industry where they think they can do something,
right?
So
I'm
sure, but I'd be willing to bet you that other people in medicine or other altruistic pursuits would tell you the same thing, that for them that it's only ramping up.
Do you take the mechanics of your day job home? So, like, are you continually thinking at home about, like, oh, maybe if we put this door over here, or, you know, finding different solutions? Because I find, like, sometimes I can't turn it off, almost to a fault. It's like, I don't need your advice right now. Like, it's like, oh, maybe we should do it this way. And like, let me just shut up.
I got a notebook by the side of my bed. But as you know, anybody who has been in the position of, you know, coming up with crazy ideas, a lot of them happen in the shower, you know,
right.
It really is. And physiological, it's when your brain is shutting down and has the time to process overnight that it can start making those mashups, and it actually makes those connections for you. So I try to turn it off. I got mechanisms. I got tricks for turning the brain off.
See if you can answer this one quickly. Weirdest mashup that you've worked on? Or most unlikely, let's say that.
Let's see. Oh, that's a good one. I'm trying to. I mean, at some point or another, we were working on defibrillators and slip and slides at the same time. So there's been some pretty weird ones.
Not a combination defibrillator and slip and slide, or like a.
Oh, see that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, now see? See
what I do?
God, man, you're good.
If you guys need a guy, you know, somebody. No, as we wind down, you've seen a lot. You've got to experience a lot of things, maybe in your industry or outside. It might be a meal you had. It might be a trip you took. But what is your current innovation crush? What do you see out there that kind of gives you goosebumps and gets you excited?
I think it sounds self-serving because we're into it, but it's kind of why we're into it. That neuromodulation and what they call electroceuticals, which is using really low voltage, tiny little implantables to address so many different conditions, I think is going to be the answer to a lot of crises right now, from opioid addiction to many other issues with pharmaceuticals and people with chronic pain and chronic conditions, which we see lots of people with chronic conditions.
Yeah.
I'm pretty excited about the technology. I mean, it's the same base technology that's used in cochlear implants, make people able to hear. It's used for pain reduction, reducing hypertension. So I think that's a pretty exciting one. And it's literally something that once it gets implanted, disappears and, you know, allows you to get on with your life. Wow. As opposed to, here, let me give you something to wear around all the time,
yeah,
or to stick on your head, or, you know, that people are going to ask you, what's that thing on the table next to you, you know? So
right.
I think that's pretty exciting. It's a little awesome. Scary to some people, but when you're into it and you see, and I think you're going to see more of it, when you see the work that everybody's doing, it's really pretty exciting.
Well, it makes me think about this, like, you know, the cultural gap that happened, or I don't know, the cultural divide that happens, or the journey of something. So there was a, let's call it the chips that you can put in a dog, right?
Like
to do the look. And then I think in some parts of Russia and some other places, it started to become popular in humans.
Yeah,
and then
people
are like, I would never, right? And then, you know, you start to have this medical implication. Like there's a trajectory of comfort, right? You start off, and you said it earlier, you said people don't like to change.
Right.
And it's like, the phrase I like is, it's not that people don't like change, they don't like transition.
They
will like where they're going once they get there, but it's the, like, I'm leaving behind something I'm comfortable and familiar with to this unknown thing, and there's a gray area in between it.
Yeah, that's good.
I don't know if I had a question there. I was just like,
I think the way I would interpret that is, it's going to happen. And I think the people that are developing it are applying some of these new technologies that might be a little scary to some areas that have to be fixed first.
Right.
And that's great. So that'll be people who are like, yes, please, whatever it takes to cure my chronic pain.
Sure.
Right. If that's what it takes, I think those results will they'll build on each other, and over time, it doesn't happen quickly, but over time, I think the acceptability and the benefits will really outweigh the fears. And I think it's going to be something that we're going to say, really? We took, you know, a dozen different pills and, you know, had terrible addictions to things when I could have just had this little, you know, seems so easy. Why did it take us 10 years to get to? But
not that we have time to get into it, but there's probably a lot of opposition you're up against. You know, when you think about like the traditional pharmaceutical, and because that's a great example, right? I can get this one-time device and do away with 12 different prescriptions. That's taking money from an entirely, you know, different industry. Like, do you?
Oh, they're all invested in it already.
Oh, okay.
GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, huge pharma company. They coined the term electroceuticals. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
cool.
I think that's
I have a whole plethora of questions around it, but I was just thinking. Yeah. You know, I think it's similarly. Like, I spoke recently at a space, and it was like PMI Science, and it didn't register to me what that was. And then I'm getting there and we're doing the talk. I'm like, oh, PMI is Philip Morris. And, but come to find out, they're working on a lot of technological solutions to smoking, you know, traditional smoking, right? So it's just finding a different way to make it healthier or alter behavior. So, based on your answer, I don't find it surprising that, you know, a lot of
they're out there looking. But I take that from the positive, which is, that's great. There really isn't a battle.
Yeah,
it's just everybody working. It's a great on the same thing.
But it's a. I feel like it's a common misperception. Like, you know, like,
there's people trying to kill ideas who killed the electric car, kind of thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Last but not least, complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is.
Innovation is mashups.
Love it. You said we were going to talk about it, and we did.
I think this is the most. You know, mashups and metaphors. I use another M in there.
I do the same thing. Yeah.
Trying to explain complicated concepts in a simple way, or, you know, trying to use things that we already have together in weird combinations.
That's great. Like slipping slides and
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you. Where can people find out more about you, your work? Dr. Eric Olson.
www.cartendesign.com, K-A-R-T-E-N design.com, all one word, has a bunch of our great projects that we're working on and links to white papers and other kind of stuff as well. So
not too ironic, it's a well-designed website.
That's right, it should be. It's one of that and our business cards, the last vestige of
I'd like to design. See. By the way, what was on your notepad? You came in here very prepared, as if you were a medical professional, but...
No, I have learned to depend on lists and things to keep all the random things bumping around in my mind. So just words like metaphors, stigma, all that kind of stuff.
I see.
Healthcare is hard.
Healthcare is hard. It should be the name of your book.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, everybody. This has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.